This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is from Kansas City, Missouri. She is a poet. Her name is Linda Rodriguez, and here she is.
In time of trouble, I was taught, go to water, running water, wash, build a small fire, sing a prayer, wash, offer tobacco, sing a prayer, clean up the fire, offer cornmeal in thanks, walk away, leaving your illness or problem behind you.
That's Linda Rodriguez, and I was sitting at a conference today with other poets, and I took out your poems and read them to them. Oh. And they really said, if she didn't write those poems, if we didn't write those kinds of poems, there's no reason for poetry. That's how impressed they were. So today we're going to explore your work and hear some of these poems that were so loved by people who didn't even know you before today. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and I'll tell you just who she is. She has 4 books of poetry, and she has edited 4 anthologies, and one won the International Latino Book Award. She has won several awards. She has been president of Border Crimes Chapter of Sisters in Crime. We got to hear about that. And she has written 3 novels. One of her short stories has been optioned for film. So this lady's serious. And before we go any further, let's hear another poem.
This is a little timely because everything we've had going on with the Dakota Access Pipeline out at Standing Rock. This is a poem I actually wrote a few years before that is part of a series of poems called First Cousin Speak. What River Says. The Cherokee call me Long Man, Yunwigunhita, because my body stretches and unravels with my head in the mountain and my feet resting in the ocean. I constantly speak words of wisdom to those who can understand me. Fewer every day. It takes a quality of attention fit for magicians or poets. I have much to tell those who expend the time and energy to listen. I have seen so many things. I know the history of rain, intimately leaning on the world to feel it on my skin and take it inside me to swell my body. Maybe they should have called me Long Woman. I remember when the mountains were home only to gods. I knew your ancestors, now tangled in the ground. I swallowed my share and more. I have seen innumerable generations living into their deaths. I am acquainted with the bones of earth, ancient as the word of God and stronger by far. Men have tried forever to change me and chain me, but I still wander where I will when I grow tired of being tame. I remain the promise of tomorrow, the hope of new growth that haunts the night with hypnotic murmurs and softens the edge between act and dream. When all hope has fled, come to me.
And we will, Linda, we will. Why are you a writer?
I have always been a writer since I was tiny. I had a terrible childhood, I think most writers did. And writing and reading is how I survived it.
That's a good answer, yes. And how is it that you have so much courage in what you write about?
I'm old. I think as we get older, we get more courage. I couldn't write about some of these things when I was younger. But, you know, I'm not actually old. I'm mature. I'm in my prime.
You're unafraid. So let's talk about courage and let us hear POW.
Okay, right here. I don't often read this at public readings anymore because the men all squirm in their seats. But when I do, I always have women come up to me afterwards in tears. At least 4 or 5 women at every reading come up and tell me, I've lived that.
That's what happened today at lunch.
POW, Before I fall into the past, I drive to the library, thumb open a book about the death of a child in Greenwich Village, and plunge back in time to trash-filled rooms smelling of milk, urine, beer, and blood, doors locked and curtains drawn against the world, dirty baby brother caged in a playpen, mother nursing broken nose, split lip, overflowing ashtray, and father filling the room to the ceiling, shouting drunken songs and threats, before whom I tremble and dance, wobbly diversion, to keep away the sound of fist against face, bone against wall. The book never shows the other little brothers and sister hiding around corners and under covers, but I know they are there and dance faster, sing the songs that give him pleasure, pay the price for their sleep later, his hand pinching flat nipples, thrusting between schoolgirl thighs. As dangerous to please as to anger, the giant who holds the keys to our family prison. Mother has no way to keep him from me, but I can do it for her and them. Locked by these pages, behind enemy lines again, where I plan futile sabotage and murder every night, 9-year-old underground, I read the end. Suddenly defiant, attacked, slammed into a wall, sliding into coma, death after the Allies arrive. Too late, in clean uniforms so like his own, to shake their heads at the smell and mess. The end I almost believe, the end that chance keeps at bay long enough for me to grow and flee, my nightmare alive on the page. Freed too late, I close the book, 2 hours vanished, stand and try to walk to the front door on uncertain legs as if nothing were wrong. No one must know. I look at those around me without seeming to, an old skill, making sure no one can tell. Panic pushes me to the car where the back window reflects a woman, the unbruised kind. In the space of 3 quick breaths, I recognize myself, slam back into adult body and life, drive home repeating a mantra, Ben will never hurt me. All men are not violent. Reminding myself to believe the first, to hope for the last. 2. Years later, my little sister will sleep pregnant, knife under her pillow, 2 stepdaughters huddled at the foot of her bed, in case her husband breaks through the door again. Finally, she escapes with just the baby. My daughter calls collect from a payphone on a New Hampshire street. She'll stay in a shelter for battered women, be thrown against the wall, returning to pack for the trip back to Missouri, a week before her 2nd anniversary. With her father and brother, the trip home will take 3 days, and she will call for me again. Anna and Kay, who sat in my classes, Vicky, who exchanged toddlers with me once a week, Pat and Karen, who shared my work, and 2 Nancys I have known, among others too many to count, hide marks on their bodies and memories. While at the Campus Women's Center, where I plan programs for women students on professional advancement and how to have it all, the phone rings every week with calls we forward to safe houses and shelters. In my adult life, I've suffered no man to touch me in anger, but I sleep light.
Linda Rodriguez, as I want to repeat what was said today at lunch, if you can't write that poem, then none of us can write anything.
Because you
have pushed back the border, pushed back the envelope, and the way you read with such clarity, honesty, and beauty is absolutely a beacon. Do people read your work? Do enough people read your work?
Well, people do read my work. Actually, the poetry book that this is in, Heart's Migration, was a tiny bestseller for a little while when it first came out because Garrison Keillor read two of my poems on two different Writer's Almanac episodes that weekend.
And this is and in it, that it, book. Yeah, let us say the title again, Heart's Migration.
Heart's Migration.
And it's still in print.
Yes, it's
People
still
can
in
get
print.
It by going online.
Tia Chucha Press, and it's also available on Amazon.
Linda Rodriguez, you have broken the ice inside of us. This is the Library of Congress. I am Grace Cavalieri, and we're going to go further and farther. Once again, what did you have to overcome to write that poem?
Well, it's actually true. I found a library book when I was taking my youngest child to pick up a book for school on the Susan Brown Miller case. Susan Brown Miller wrote on this case.
I do
in
know
Greenwich
that.
Village.
I do know that.
And I read it, and it did throw me back into my just like a flashback.
So that triggered the poem.
It triggered it.
I see. And so you're carrying forth the message, really, from that book. Being of Cherokee blood, what does that mean?
Well, you know, I'm very careful with that because I'm not an actual citizen of the Cherokee tribe. I'm lucky enough that the Cherokee tribe of Oklahoma, the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma, has been very kind and welcoming to me. I have heritage. But I think it's important to make that distinction clear because all of these tribes are sovereign nations, and citizenship is really the most important thing. Many of them, like the Cherokee, have people who have heritage who are connected with the community and active with the community.
But you're granted citizenship, though?
No. Citizenship comes with certain documentation. I think... you know, you have to have a certificate of degree of Indian blood. The federal government has certain measures that must be met. And then each individual nation has its own measures that they call for. The Cherokee wants you to trace to documents to an ancestor on the Dawes Rolls. My ancestor that I can trace to was in what's known as the Old Settlers before the Dawes Rolls. But I try and make that really clear because it really is important because we tend to forget that they're sovereign nations
and
citizenship is an important thing.
Thank you for that very much, for explaining that. And now let's go back to your poetry. Linda Rodriguez, we are so proud to have you.
This poem, I wrote this poem when I was doing my, this is an old poem, I wrote it when I was doing my graduate degree in creative writing. And I had all white male professors, and I don't mean to diss them because they were great to me. They were very encouraging. But they really felt, they kept telling me I shouldn't write anything that came from my Cherokee heritage, and I shouldn't write anything that came from the Latino culture I'd lived in because it just wasn't universal enough. And this was a poem that's actually based on an old Cherokee teaching tale that my grandmother told me many times when I was young, and I got it past them because I slipped a Greek goddess into the title,
oh,
and that made
it
universal.
Oh, that is a riot.
It's called Meeting Hecate. How I fear the witch in me, the one in touch with power, the one who knows without knowing how, the secret priestess, spirit bearer, the ugly side of woman. The crone. And I remember the Cherokee legend of stone skin, superhuman cannibal devouring whole villages, how the people saw him coming and set up a fortress of women menstruating, how the sight of each weakened stone skin until he died and dying told them all the secrets, ways of power, conjure spells, ways to do things. The Cherokee live off the wisdom of a dying monster and the power of bleeding women, and they remember this. There is a witch somewhere in every woman.
I love you. I love you. Give me more.
Well, this is for Frida Kahlo.
Yes, and tell us who she was.
Frida Kahlo was a very famous Mexican painter. She was the wife of a very famous male Mexican muralist, and he was much more famous during his lifetime than she was. She has outshone him since, and she's very popular. And so I wrote this for her. She's someone that's very special to, been special to me since I was very young. Crow Mother for Frida Kahlo. They have a memory for faces, my pretty birds. They are believers in vengeance. Forgiveness is not in their DNA. My shiny black sweethearts will eat out the hearts of those who harm them one day. This is why I love them so. They are like me in their smart fierceness, their desire for payback. We who have been hurt part our shiny black hair down the middle, tuck in a flower or two, pull on layers of bright fabric for camouflage, and sharpen our talons and beaks in anticipation. I will curve my claws into paintbrushes and carve my revenge into the souls of those who wrong me. I abstain from forgiveness of grave accidents. Neither Diego nor God shall escape me. This is why I live on when they are dead. We recognize the human in the crow and the caw at the base of every human throat. Come, my black beauties, I've lost my wings, but you can stab me with your beaks, hundreds of you, and hold me in the air above life's afflictions. Don't fear the pain you'll inflict. It won't be the first time I've suffered the death of unos cuantos pequetitos. I hadn't planned on living eternally in that cursed America, alive on every bottle and tchotchke, photoshopped onto muscular bodies in jockey shorts, the U.S.'s favorite saleswoman. But no one knows who Diego is any longer, except as the bastard who drove me mad. Pierce me, my sweet little carrion eaters, and lift me into eternal life in a cloud of bloody revenge.
Well, you captured her spirit, I'll say that. Linda Rodriguez, I'm Grace Cavalieri. How do you start a novel? With a character or with a situation?
I start, you know, usually you have to have a character and a situation come together to form kind of the little piece of particle of sand that's at the core of what will become a pearl, and it grows by accretion. But I believe with F. Scott Fitzgerald that character is key to all. As a matter of fact, I just recently published a book, my first writing instruction book, called Plotting the Character-Driven Novel, because I believe all plot, all story, ultimately arises out of character.
And how long does it take you to write a novel?
It depends on the novel. Some of them go faster than others. The mystery novels I've written can go faster because they're in the same world with the same major character. So a lot of that work is done already, and so I'm settling into certain things. When I write literary novels, fantasy novels, then fantasy novels take a long time because there's tremendous world building. You build it, create it all from nothing.
What fun!
And there is no more fun than creating a world through a novel, whether it's a mystery novel or a fantasy novel. You're always creating a world. You're creating these people. Even if it's happening in the modern day, you're creating that world. Even if you set it in Washington, D.C. here, you're still creating the Washington, D.C. of that novel. And it is, when it's going well, I hate to say this, don't tell my husband I said it, it's even better than sex, which is what keeps you going.
Now I know why you write novels. That is terrific.
Poetry is like a compulsion.
Well, you know, it's very interesting that you can do all of this. And the energy that it takes for a poet is sort of like, I call it a sprinter. But the novelist is a marathon person. So can you really spend day after day after day with that obsession?
Yes.
And not try to rush it?
Yeah, you have to with a novel. Poetry, though, like any particular one of these poems that I picked up, it is like a sprinter. You know, you get the idea, you write it, or you write fragments toward it in a concentrated effort. But then you come back to it.
But which do you think is your métier?
I love writing novels. Poetry is like a compulsion for me. I think the impulse toward poetry arises from are you familiar with the Jewish term tikkun olam? That's a Hebrew phrase that means to mend the world. It's what we are called to heal the world, to mend the broken world.
That's the title of your next book.
Your next book
of poems, because that's what you do.
I think that's the impulse behind poetry, and that's a compulsion I probably will always have. I don't see ever escaping
it.
Well,
read us another compulsion.
Okay. This is a poem called Indian Removal Cartography. It's an old map. Looks hand-drawn. Starting in Georgia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Alabama, a broad swath of territory belonging to the Cherokee, yet shrunken so from where the first Europeans found them, that kidney-shaped province splayed across the states contracts down to these thin lines, marking the paths they were forced to travel. This old-looking map has been modified for the modern scholar, with gray-banded place names highlighted. When you hover a computer mouse over one of these shaded names, pertinent facts appear. From Nuichota, capital of the Cherokee Nation in 1838, now a state park, to Fort Butler, one of five North Carolina stockades where Cherokee were held under foul conditions, to Fort Payne, yet another removal fort and internment camp in Alabama, to Ross's Landing, where more than 2,000 were held prisoner and departed in three large groups to travel to Indian Territory by water. The Unicoi Turnpike, an ancient war and trading path, took other groups onto the Trail of Tears, is now designated a Millennial Trail. Charleston, Tennessee, where 13,000 were held for months waiting to begin their unwilling trek across five states in winter. Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Chief Whitepath died and was buried here, remarkable for being one of the few whose graves are known. Hover long enough over Hopkinsville, and the screen will tell you. Most of the thousands of Cherokees who died on the trail lie in unmarked graves.
Linda Rodriguez, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. What do you tell the women? What is the first thing you say to your women's group that you work with, your program? What is the one thing that you say to them that you hope they'll take away?
Do you mean the Women's Center? Yeah, I had to leave the Women's Center finally for medical reasons, but I was there for decades and decades. I ran the Women's Center at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And we wanted to make it possible for them to be fully realized human beings in this world. And that's very difficult for women. It's very difficult for people of color in this world. And that was what we worked toward, and we wanted them to work toward.
How did you do it?
We did tons of things. We had programs to mentor young girls with women in the sciences who had successful careers in the sciences and would take them into their laboratories and their offices and their classrooms and teach them and all. And we had a leadership program for our women alums who went out in the workplace and found themselves smack up against not even the glass ceiling, but the ceiling way, way below the glass ceiling, in which we taught them how to negotiate across hierarchy and how to you know, conflict resolution strategies.
Does
and all
it
kinds
make
of
changes?
Things. It does. It's slow, but it does. I have seen in my lifetime so many changes. When I first started at the Women's Center, marital rape was, to be married was, that got you completely off for rape. If you raped your wife, violently raped your wife and beat her up, you know, it was in that, in the state of Missouri and in many states, it was only in the late 80s that I think they got it off of all the state.
Well, votes. You've done a lot of work on every level, and let us hear a final poem.
Okay. My most recent adventure in life has been battling breast cancer. And so this is, I do some chemo and it's preventative. I'm cancer free and this is preventative. And my chemo is fairly mild and I only do it every 6 months. But I go to the chemo clinic and I'm surrounded by mostly women and they're just incredible, courageous warriors. And I wrote this one afternoon while I was sitting there going through it. In the chemo clinic. In the chemo clinic today, cushy chairs raise us above the ground like children with feet dangling until the nurses put us in recline with our feet out in front of us and our heads tilted back. Fluorescent colored bags hang from rolling chrome towers, a different color for each of us. We're having a real party here this cold, rainy afternoon. Colorful plastic lines drip the bright liquids into us, everyone to her own poison. It's just us girls here today, no guys this time. Gaunt, gray-cheeked, white-haired, if we had any left. Girls, except a few of us who have swelled like helium balloons pumped to the breaking with the pills we take at home, and of course the nurses, so good at finding collapsed veins and installing new ports. We're trading jokes, cemetery humor, and laughing, even if some eyes look scared or tired of the fight. No one willing to be the party pooper, though all too familiar with the job those bright-colored chemicals leaving the bags for our bodies do on the gut. Everyone laughing and praying, let me keep it down. Let me make it out and home before it hits. Let me make it. Let me not die and leave the drab dripping trees that I know will put out new shoots, green and lacy in the spring. Let me live to see them. Let me be one of the ones who beats this. Let me make it. Please, let me make it.
The voice of Linda Rodriguez. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this possible. The program is funded by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation and Friends of Poetry, Hiram LaRue, Candace Katz, and Allison Hedge Koch. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.